This choir has been among the group of members here at UCS that has made an extraordinary effort to welcome me by singing here today and orient me. And I'm so pleased that both the choir and the band could be part of this first service that we share today. I cannot begin this sermon without offering these thanks first to each and every one of you who've been part of the process that has brought us all together. Our board president, Corinne Barwis, who's not able to be here today, our worship team leader, Rosalie Claves, our director of religious education, Linda Weaver, and former staff members, Chris Adams, Cindy Gayante, have been particularly generous with their time in the ways that we have all been oriented. So I offer these thanks not only for myself, but also for Andrew and for Laura. The list of other board officers and volunteers who've reached out to these new staff members and helped us all land on our feet would be very long if I recited everyone. So know that you're all appreciated and that you have confirmed for us the intuition that we had that UUCS would be a great community to be a part of and to serve. I started my part in the service today with the story of the three questions because it sums up what I've been trying to do with all of my anxiety about this new adventure that we're embarking on. And my head has truly been spinning with those same questions. What is the best time to begin new things? What is the most important thing to do first? And who should I be talking to? I'm sure that you're congregation's leaders had the same kind of head-spinning questions happening inside them from the moment that Reverend Anya made her announcement last spring. So let's all take the wisdom of the story to heart and recognize that we do things one at a time. The next thing that comes up with the next person you interact with here in the congregation, with as much presence and patience and love as you can muster, is always going to be the best and the most important thing to do with the most important person that there is. I feel compelled also to start this sermon today by stating the obvious. I am not Reverend Anya. And it's a little strange, isn't it, to get to this familiar point in the startup of the church year and not have her here, especially for those of you who joined this congregation during her ministry. And maybe have not had another Unitarian Universalist minister in your lives. Despite the fact that you've had regular guest ministers in the pulpit, and you did go through a sabbatical period a couple of years ago when Reverend Anya was away, it's different now because there isn't any clear end to this unfamiliar time. My commitment is to be with you for at least a year, maybe two, maybe another minister will do the second year. And during that second year, you will be anticipating a new settled minister who will be with you long term. And I'm sure some of you are wondering why it has to take that long, and whether all of the things that Reverend Anya meant to you and would do with and for you are still going to be present and available. So I won't pretend that I'm here to take her place, or that everything will stay the same. Some of you may have actually joined a minister rather than joining a church, and you might be aware of that, or you might not even know it yet. You're checking me out, you're reserving judgment, or you're checking the entire congregation out all over again to see how connected you feel to this community. All of these feelings and questions are things that we expect during a time of transition. People who serve in these interim ministries do play a little different role and have some unique training to help congregations through this time. So there are two important things about interim ministers that I should make sure that you all know from the outset. The first is that from the very beginning, interim ministers know that they cannot be candidates to stay with the congregation longer than the interim contract. So you can take some comfort in knowing I'm kind of like the weather. If you don't like what's happening, just wait a while, and it is going to change. And the second thing you ought to know is that interim ministers do have a kind of job description that they bring in with them that are t- tasks that we are asked to help the congregation engage with during a time of transition, and to invite the congregation to engage in some unique tasks of your own. So we will be talking about those and especially giving an overview on all of them for those of you who might like to get this and participate in understanding this time of transition better at a Saturday morning workshop, probably coming up the first weekend in October for all who can come, and we'll advertise that soon. For now, let me just tell you that a very big part of this time that we're going to go through together this year is composed of telling and listening to each other's stories about our relationships with this congregation and to Unitarian Universalism. Sometimes people can sit side by side in a congregation for years and share in tasks and services and social events at church and still not know some of the best stories about our lives that we carry around inside us. And sometimes people who have been members for what seems to be a long time have never actually heard some of the deeper historical stories of how this congregation came to be, or the story of the congregations that have fed into the creation of this one, or the story of how Unitarian Universalism came to be in this region and in this country in which we live. So it's a good time, a transition time is a good time to tell or retell some of those stories and to claim the larger story that we're part of. So I should tell you my story and then tell you a little bit about what I've already heard about yours, and we can start from there. My own story starts with what the poet George Eliot called the choir invisible. Those immortal dead, he wrote, who live again in minds made better by their presence. I am 100% both sides of my family Icelandic, and Icelanders are renowned for their interest in ancestry and genealogy. So I've always been intrigued by lineage. In a denomination where most members are come-outers or newcomers to this faith, I am a fourth generation Unitarian Universalist who is here this morning in this pulpit because during Easter week in 1891, my maternal great-grandparents, Einar and Oddfríður, decided to go to church on Hekla Island in the middle of Lake Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada. And that Sunday, they heard a sermon from a Lutheran Universalist-leaning circuit-riding minister named Magnus Skuptason, who proclaimed that God's love for all creation would save all souls in time, even the souls of sinners. And that sermon changed their lives, and it made my life possible. So they are part of the choir invisible that's here this morning. I grew up from six blocks from the Unitarian Church in Winnipeg, attending church with my grandmother and my mother, occasionally my father. My mother had been active in our youth movement, and she encouraged me to get involved in it. I went directly to Harvard Divinity School after graduating from the University of Toronto, and there at Harvard Divinity School, I encountered many other souls that became part of my choir invisible, represented by plaques on the dormitory room doors and in the chapel of Divinity Hall that honored the Unitarian luminaries that had lived in those dorm rooms and preached in that building and in the neighborhood of Boston. So I own that lineage as my own. I started serving congregations when I was 25, and I've had a boring life. I've never done anything else since. One of the other lineages that I gradually came to own throughout my years in ministry because of Unitarian Universalism was the lineage of whiteness that I did not understand and took for granted when I was growing up in Canada. Now, of course, biologically, Icelandic people are about the whitest people you can find on Earth. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the lineage of whiteness as a social construct as a set of ideas in our heads that determine who has power and who has privileges. So my first denominational experiences in Unitarian Universalism were shaped by the Black Empowerment Movement of 1968 to 1970. And I had an opportunity to serve for 16 years at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church in Charlottesville, just at the time when contemporary scholarship about Jefferson was casting a spotlight on this complicated legacy that he left behind as the most famous Unitarian in history, the Unitarian who wrote the words, "All men are created equal," and who relied on 300 slaves to support his life. He's part of our, he's part of my lineage as a Unitarian Universalist. And that's something I work on and work, and that is an important part of my identity as a Unitarian Universalist. So that's three lineages that are important to me in different ways. My lineage as an Icelander, my UU heritage lineage, and my lineage that I'm not very comfortable with in this white supremacist culture as a white man of privilege. And there's a fourth one that I want you to know about that arises through my own spiritual practice over time, and that's a lineage in Zen Buddhism. I have been a Zen student for 30 years, formal Zen student. I affirm a lineage of Buddhist teachers that dates back 2,500 years that have shaped who I am and that guide me going forward. So they too are part of my choir invisible. So when I stand in this pulpit for the first time to preach to you, I remember that I'm preaching not only to the congregation here, but I'm also preaching to the choir. I'm preaching to the choir in more ways than one, however. And maybe we can talk about some of those other ways. I'm sure now you understand, I feel I'm preaching to the choir invisible that made it possible for me to be here and that shapes who I am. But the second awareness I have is that I'm also preaching to the choir in the conventional way that we use and understand that phrase. In the English language idiom, preaching to the choir means that you're talking within a bubble of people who already think and feel much the same way as you do about issues in the world, and you're probably telling them what they want to hear. For much of my ministry, preaching to the choir in this sense has been both a comfort and kind of a disappointment. Unitarian Universalist congregations today remain a precious, refreshing oasis of liberal religious thought and practice that embody the beloved community that we hope to create in the wider world. To be able to speak my truth and share my spiritual journey in front of our congregations has been a great blessing in my life. But I've always wished more people were listening. And like you, I'm sure I wish that our efforts would result in our life-affirming message breaking through to influence the larger culture in more dramatic ways. So this is a question that's worth asking ourselves in the interim period ahead. Is our best aspiration to be the yeast that helps the bread to rise? Is our greatest impact going to be through the interfaith partnerships that we are so accomplished at encouraging and leading? Does it matter whether more people know what Unitarian Universalism is if the values we stand for are being widely affirmed in so many corners of our culture today, both religious and secular? There's a third way in which I recognize this morning that I would be preaching to the choir, and that has to do with all of you and your story. I told you earlier that an important task of our time together at the beginning would be to tell each other and to listen to each other's stories. And I've been listening. You all have a collective story, which I think many of you probably know, maybe most of you, that begins with, "Once upon a time, there was a choir." So let me tell you how I've heard this story so far, while recognizing that every story can be told in a lot of different ways. What I've heard is this: the choir sang in a church, and the church loved the choir, and the The choir loved the church until they didn't. These things happen in families and in marriages and in friendships and in churches. There's ups and downs. People change. There's sometimes conflict. When people's needs change, sometimes they have to move on. So that's what this choir did. They moved on. And people said, well, you can't have a choir unless you have a church. People said, well, let's see how long they like being a choir with no church. People said, well, we'll get a new choir. I bet they'll all come back real soon. But this choir didn't buy into any of that. And even though they had moved on, there was something they recognized about what it means to be a choir that is also absolutely crucial about what it means to be a church. That something has a fancy word from science that describes it. It's the word synergy. The easiest way to talk about it when synergy applies to people is that you can create something new that you could hardly have imagined when you started by sticking together rather than going it alone. So this story has a happy ending, and we all know what it is. The choir did stick together, and they did create something that they could hardly have imagined at the beginning, something brand new. They created this congregation. Didn't happen automatically just because they liked to sing together and because they enjoyed each other. It happened because they figured out for themselves that the choir could be better and could be stronger and could be more sustainable if they did have a church. And of course, any church they joined would want to have this choir. So finally, the solution became obvious. The choir would have to become the church, and the church would have to become all the best things about the choir. So let's think for just a minute before I end today about all the best things about choirs, and especially choirs that are part of churches. Because I have the floor, I get to tell you the first few I think of, and maybe, I don't know if we'll have time, it looks like I'm running too long. We can talk afterwards about some of the other things about choirs that you think are the best things. But here's my top five best things about choirs. Number five, church choirs want everybody to join in. And even if you're like me and you really can't sing, there's always something you can do to help the choir, even if it's just listening and appreciating. Number four, choirs honor what everybody does naturally. The basses get to be basses, and the sopranos get to be sopranos, and everybody has their own part to sing. And if there's an odd person that can sing more than one part, I'm sure the choir will figure out how to make use of that too. Number three, church choirs want to be both and. They want to sing a repertoire that's both accessible and challenging, that's both classical and popular, that's both mournful and joyful. Number two, church choirs are there to have fun. They want to put on a good performance, of course, but aside from the director, everybody's making a choice to be there every week. And if people aren't having a good time, there's no choir. And the number one best thing about church choirs, they understand that the reason they are singing is because they're part of something bigger than themselves. For some choir members, it might not start out that way. The reasons they joined the choir might be all about them. But over time, I think most choir members come to appreciate something that everybody who gets committed to a choir will understand, that the choir isn't really about them. And there's language that more Orthodox churches would use to describe what I'm talking about here. They might say the choir is the servant to the liturgy, or that the liturgy is being performed not for the people in the congregation that's watching them sing, but is being performed for God. And that everybody in the church is actually part of the choir. Only some people are singing with their voices, and some people are singing with their hearts. Now, even if God language isn't your cup of tea, I don't think it matters, because I bet you understand what I'm talking about anyway. You recognize that the five best things about being part of a church choir are also the five best things about being part of a church, especially a church like this one. Everybody's invited in. Everybody's gifts and talents are honored and used. We try to figure out the both and rather than live in the either or. We are very earnest about what we do, and we want to do it well, but we never forget that we're here to enjoy the common life that we share. And number one, it's not about me. It's about all of us and the synergy that we create that makes this church community something new and something beyond anything that any of us could have imagined or created on our own, including this minister, including your next minister. We're doing it together, and we're doing it with the choir invisible that is composed of all of those who were here once but are here no longer, and all of those who are part of the larger church that we share in and who care deeply about what happens here. And we're doing it because, as Mark Nepo said in the poem I read earlier, the great thoughts that we sing and the great that we think and the great songs that we sing are all in rehearsal for the majesty of being held by this life that we have been given. May we exult in the gladness of sharing those thoughts and songs together in the year ahead. Amen.